Hello and welcome to Ag PhD Radio. Thanks for joining us today. Really excited to be talking about some of the important nutrients in our soils and for our crops. We're going to focus on calcium and sulfur on today's program. We're getting a lot of soil tests in, a lot of people looking for second opinions or maybe first opinions, or just to double check that they're thinking along the same lines that we might be on some of the fertility things going on in fields. We're seeing brand new soil test data coming through, and there is a big focus on sulfur this year. Brian, this is one of those nutrients that I don't think most farms are putting enough sulfur on.
Well, probably not, but I would say for soybeans, maybe they are. I mean, maybe there's enough out there. Corn, yeah, probably not. And I will tell you, the last 2 years, just looking at sulfur and nitrogen tests, it was no surprise to me that they were both low because we had record rainfall in 2018 and 2019, and those are leachable nutrients, you know, when they're in the form of sulfate and nitrate. But anyway, this fall, when I'm still seeing low levels of nitrate and sulfate, what's that telling you? That means that we just simply are not applying enough both nitrogen and sulfur in some cases. I'm not saying in all cases, but in some cases we're seeing really, really low levels. Now, certainly if you've got light soil, you're not going to be able to hold these leachables. Let's say you're in Mississippi and you've got a 3 cation exchange capacity, so it's pure sand, and you get 100 inches between rainfall and irrigation on your ground every year, yeah, you're not holding sulfate at all. But for us, where we have heavy soil, cold temps, not much rainfall, haven't had a decent rain in 3.5 months, you know what? We should have a little bit higher sulfur levels than we do. So we've got to make sure that we are applying some every year and that we're looking at soil tests to make sure that it is indeed out there.
It's interesting, too, with the calcium piece, and I know when we talk with Neil Kinsey about this, and we hope to have him on later on today in the program, that calcium is one of those nutrients that he's focused on pretty early in, let's take this piece of ground that needs a lot of work. It's not going to take very long for Neil to get focused on that calcium. It's a big player out there, too.
Yeah, it is, but, I mean, we're lucky in the upper Midwest, southern Canada. We have, for the most part, good levels of calcium. So, you know, as long as you're above 65% on a base saturation test, I'm really not too worried about it. You might have to add a little bit if you've got some low pH soil, but otherwise, you know, for the most part, that one's pretty good. And calcium stays in the soil much better than what sulfur does. So if we're talking about both calcium and sulfur, I would just say with the sulfur, that's the one you got to focus on every single year, because keep in mind, we have much cleaner air than we did 20 or 30 years ago, so we don't get free sulfur raining down from the sky like they still do in China today. All those farmers get all the sulfur they need for free every single year just when they get natural rainfall because their air is so polluted. We don't have that luxury. So I call it a luxury. Yeah, we wouldn't live as long, but we'd have free sulfur. But anyway, then the other thing you can't forget is if you have high levels of organic matter, you're going to have some mineralization there, which means you're going to get free sulfur every year out of your organic matter. We usually figure 2 to 3 pounds for every 1% of organic matter. So a lot of our soil, I've been looking at our soil tests here lately, 4% organic matter is kind of our average now. We built that up. So 4% times, let's say, at a minimum, 2 pounds, well, we're getting like 8 pounds of sulfur for free. And that's great, but a good corn crop's probably going to need 30, 40, maybe even 50 pounds. I mean, think about that. That's a lot of pounds. It's not a micronutrient. It's a secondary nutrient. Calcium and sulfur are secondary nutrients. Your crops need a lot of them. They don't need a quarter pound or half pound. They need dozens of pounds in a lot of cases, so you got to have decent levels.
Yeah, these are important nutrients, and really all the essential nutrients are important. So don't get us wrong that, oh, these are the silver bullets here, that we have to have calcium and we have to have sulfur, and that's going to turn my farm from 180 bushel corn farm to 300 bushel just like that. No, but they are big and important nutrients. They're secondary nutrients, which means we don't need quite as many pounds as the NPK in most cases, but we definitely need a significant amount, and they're nutrients that are easy to get too. This is one thing that I found interesting, Brian, is just how many different ways you can get calcium or ways you can get sulfur. When we get emails from literally all over the world, there's so many different sources of calcium and sulfur that farmers are using out there.
Yeah, for sure. The sulfur especially. almost any micronutrient you can get in a blend with sulfur. And, I mean, there's certainly gypsum, which is calcium sulfate. You've got ammonium sulfate, nitrogen and sulfur. And that reminds me, I should really mention nitrogen, too. We talk about sulfur quite often. One of the biggest benefits when your crop has a level of sulfur is it's going to be much more efficient using nitrogen. So we're not saying here you need to get carried away on sulfur, but you at least have to get some out there so your crop is more efficient using nitrogen and it can achieve the yield that it should reach.
Yeah, that's for sure. And you know, the soil testing this year has not been easy, Brian. We've had a lot of questions about that with dry soils in many parts of farming communities. And yeah, getting those soil tests pulled is so critical.
Well, yeah, I mean, it might be a little bit of a challenge because it's hard to get the probe in the ground, number one. And number two, there have been some people coming out here over the last year saying, yeah, sulfur tests aren't super accurate. Well, I hate to break it to you, but no tests are super accurate. I mean, you can go test the ground 50 times and you might get just slightly different results every time. But I want you to think about this. So what they're talking about is, okay, let's say there are actually 30 pounds of sulfur in your soil. It's possible that the reading might show 25 or it might show 35 or whatever. Okay, that's still in the same ballpark. You're relatively close. That's good enough. You're close. Where I'm going with this is you're not at 30 and then, oh, it's giving you a reading of 1. No, that's not the case. So don't get too worried about these people that tell you, oh, don't soil sample this year or don't soil sample ever because they're not accurate. Well, no, they're not perfect, but they are really close.
All right, we're talking about calcium and sulfur and how important they are for crops and what you should be looking for in your soils and how you can feed your upcoming crop. Like we mentioned, there's a lot of different things here that go into what calcium does and what sulfur does in your soil and for your plant. And I'm sure you'll see today that, wow, these are nutrients I probably should learn a little bit more about and see on my farm if they can make a difference for me. Our phone lines will be open too at 844-44-AG-PHD. Stay tuned.
Revitech fungicide from BASF has been specifically developed for the selective soybean grower who doesn't compromise. If you think good is good enough, if you're okay with just achieving rather than overachieving, if average is your goal, this is not the fungicide for you. Revitech fungicide, brand new chemistry, 3 no-excuse modes of action, 0 modes of compromise. Sounds like the fungicide for you. Revitech fungicide from BASF, that's smart. Always read and follow label directions.
Acre to acre, year to year, generation to generation, nobody scrutinizes performance like you do. And acre to acre, year to year, generation to generation, the consistent performance of Vasgro brand soybeans helps to keep your profitability out in front, offering leading agronomic expertise and 100% exclusive genetics for strong yield potential. Ask your dealer how much further you can grow when Vasgro leads the way. Always read and follow grain marketing and all other stewardship practices and pesticide label directions.
You deserve to have a building that will last for generations. With more than 110 years of experience and thousands of satisfied customers, Morton Buildings is the industry leader you can trust. Unlike other construction companies, you work with Morton Buildings craftsmen from conception to completion. There's no better time to buy. Lock in your new building for 2020 today. Contact your local Morton sales office or visit mortonbuildings.com.
As a little girl, I always wanted to run the combine because it meant I was helping Dad. And Dad always said, farmers are helpers. I'm teaching that to my daughters, that farmers help our family, our neighbors, and our community. It's what I do at work. I help farmers get the equipment they need. My name is Kim, I'm a farmer, and I work for Case IH.
Case IH, built by farmers.
Welcome back, you're listening to Ag PhD Radio. Thanks for joining us today. We're talking about building and managing calcium and sulfur on your farm, two very important secondary nutrients and things that will show up on your soil test that you should be watching for in addition to N, P, K, and all the other nutrients that your crops need. Our phone lines are open throughout today's program. If you've got a soil test you want to share with us, you can email us, radio at agphd.com. You can also follow up with a phone call if you'd like, 844 44 Ag PhD and talk to us about, hey, you got my soil test now. How am I doing here? And what should I do? What would you do if it was your farm? That kind of thing. We would love to chat with you. That would be fun. We've got our friend Stephanie Zelenko on right now with AgriLiquid. Stephanie, how are you doing?
I'm not too bad. How about yourself?
Pretty good. All right. I made a bold claim earlier that I don't know that it's really super bold, but I was saying to Brian, I think sulfur may be one of the, probably nutrients that everybody needs that they're missing out on, that they're running short of. What would you say? You get to work with growers all across the country. Do you see the same thing? Are guys running short of sulfur?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, especially this spring when we had a lot of cool, damp weather, we saw a lot of sulfur deficiency in our corn crop and even a wheat crop. And I just think it's one of those nutrients that we're getting better at managing, but historically it's kind of been forgotten about, and we have to kind of get into that mindset so we start managing that better.
All right. So certainly you get to work with a lot of different crops across the whole country, but when you think about sulfur deficiency, you mentioned corn and wheat, but what do you normally see with a sulfur deficiency in a crop?
So sulfur deficiency, you know, it is those grass crops. So corn and wheat is where we most commonly see that. And it's just very simply yellowing. It can sometimes look like nitrogen deficiency. The biggest key is it tends to be the entire plant, especially early on, that looks yellow, where nitrogen deficiency tends to be that older growth or those bottom leaves of a corn plant.
All right. When we talk about putting sulfur out, we're doing soil testing right now on our farm. We're getting results back and we see, oh, okay, we don't have a whole lot of sulfur left at the end of the year. Not necessarily a bad thing, right, with a leachable nutrient, but how soon can we start putting sulfur back out? And are there soil conditions like ours in the north where our soil is literally going to be frozen for 6 months? Do we have to worry so much about loss here like guys in lighter soils in the south would worry about?
So I treat sulfur a lot like nitrogen just because, like you said, it is a leachable nutrient. And so, you know, if we're going to get those long periods of frozen ground, like we get, you know, in those high northern climates, then you have a little bit more protection from loss. But I still get concerned about those wet springs where we get, you know, that thaw, especially, you know, where I come from in Michigan, that we can get a lot of rainfall. And as soon as those soils warm up, we can get some of that, you know, sulfur movement and see a little bit of leaching. You know, there's opportunity to put some out as those weather is cool. I like to see a lot of that out in the spring or even in season just because there is such a potential to have that sulfur lost through the soil.
Yeah, if you're making a spring application, it's pretty easy to throw a little bit of sulfur in with a burn down herbicide or throw it in with a residual herbicide or with other fertilizer that's going out. There's a lot of opportunity to do that. So you're right. We wouldn't necessarily have to get that done in the fall. When we look at sulfur, though, there are a lot of different forms. And I see the sulfate form of sulfur. I was just talking with somebody about that. And they said, oh, I got to make sure I've got the sulfate form of sulfur. Talk to us about the forms of sulfur and why certain products have worked a little better than others.
So the sulfate form of sulfur is the plant usable form. So when we're looking at those in-season applications or times when we actually have the plant growing and want to have quick uptake from it, that sulfate form of sulfur is what we're going to be looking for. If we're looking for, you know, more of a slower release, you know, there's other forms of ammonium thiosulfate or that thiosulfate form or elemental form, those need time to break down and they need the biology in the soil to do that. So those are the ones that we can put out. And then if we have cold soils, wait for that biology to wake up in the spring and start that conversion for us and then convert that into that sulfate form. And so, you know, those different sulfurs play different roles. Some of them will help us with pH adjustment. Some of them are going to be out there to feed the crop. And so I think it depends upon what you're looking for that sulfur source to do and then kind of tie that in with the time of year you're making that application.
All right. Now, speaking about the time of year, you kind of mentioned we can spoon feed this out there. We can put a little bit out at different times. But I know the safety near the seed is a caution. You don't want to put a whole bunch of sulfur right in the furrow, but you can use a little bit. How do you draw that line? What kind of guidelines do you have?
So that's correct. Sulfur is one of those nutrients that has high injury potential. So whether we're talking in furrow safety or if we're looking at a foliar application, you have to be really, really careful. And so we have a product, Enhance, We know that that product, it's 8.7% sulfur, is pretty safe in furrow up to 2 quarts per acre. That we've done a lot of testing at a research farm that we're confident that we can go to that 2 quarts in furrow. You know, there's always those exceptions to the rules. If you have really sandy soil or dry growing conditions where that fertilizer is going to stay in contact with the soil, you have a little bit more, you know, risk potential in there. But if you have good moisture and good planting conditions, I'm confident with that product. If you get with those higher analysis, whether it's ATS or our Access product or Escalate, those have higher analysis, 14 or 17% sulfur in it, then we're talking things that we need to put away from that seed. So a 2x2 application, or mix it with your UAN solution and get that out in another form where it has a little bit safer placement, so you're not going to worry about injuring that seed any.
Now, you mentioned sandy soils, and I realize this is a whole different subject than very heavy soils in the north and high organic matter soils. How about those sandy soils? How do you get sulfur out there during the year? Because there's a lot of really high-yield farmers that have got really low CEC soils.
Right. So, you know, sandy soils, again, are all relative to where you live. So when I think sandy soils, you're talking those CECs in the single digits or the lower ends of those single digits. And they do have more challenges as far as getting all their nutrients out, whether we're talking, you know, the P and K through the planter or sulfur here. And so, again, it's kind of looking at that full system approach of when they can most safely put it out. Enhanced, I'd still be comfortable putting some of that out through the planter. A lot of times those high yield guys are having water tied in with that, so they're going to have good soil moisture that you don't have to be so concerned about. Again, if we're in those severe dry land conditions where we haven't had rainfall anytime near planting, you know, I'm going to just make that decision to back that sulfur out of there and look at another timing, whether it's with the nitrogen application or, you know, even tying it in with a foliar application later on in the season.
When we're looking at our soil tests, and I was just spending a little time with Rob Fritz here in the office looking through some soil tests on some of my ground, one of the things that we've noticed when we've got a poorly drained spot, we've got a huge amount of sulfur sometimes in those areas. When you're looking for sulfur tests, is there a depth that you like to see those tests from? Is a standard 6-inch test good enough, or do you like to see occasionally a 24-inch deep sample just like you would with nitrogen?
So I guess I've never really thought about that just because I'm usually looking at, you know, a planter time application. So that 6 to 8 inch is where I normally look. But I guess if we have those poorly drained soils, it really wouldn't be a whole lot different than the nitrogen because, again, I treat nitrogen and sulfur pretty similar when it comes to making a fertility recommendation. And so as that root system grows, it will tap into those deeper samples. And so if you have a poorly drained situation where you have an accumulation of sulfur, you know, I would absolutely take that into account just because, you know, those are dollars you've spent in the past for a fertility program that you should be able to utilize in that next cropping season.
Hey, one last question, Stephanie. I know you work a lot with both dry land and irrigated growers. Do you see anything different in the dry land versus the irrigated? Are there any opportunities? You can't really put it over the top much, can you? Can you do low rates?
You can do low rates on certain crops with certain products. So we have seen a little bit of a benefit from going foliar applications with Enhance. You know, the biggest difference I see between irrigated and dry land is going to be, you know, that yield potential. And in most cases, you can get out the sulfur that you need in other ways with that dry land grower that doesn't have that high yield. If you're talking to those high yield guys that are really pushing the yield through irrigation, you know, then they have that opportunity that you could go over the top through a pivot application or drip tape. I think it's just all into that overall cropping system of how you can best apply that sulfur.
Talking to Stephanie Zelenko here with AgriLiquid. Stephanie, thank you so much. Really appreciate having you on.
You're welcome. Have a good day.
Talking about calcium and sulfur, and I guess I got into the sulfur a lot with Stephanie. Probably should have talked a little bit more calcium. I know she's working on some pretty exciting things with calcium, even in the furrow, that look kind of interesting. We'll talk more about these important nutrients coming up right after this. You're listening to Ag PhD Radio.
Got resistant weeds? Add Tough 5EC as your post-emergence tank mix partner to deliver the knockout punch to Palmer amaranth and water hemp. Tough 5EC is a selective contact herbicide for post-emergence control of key broadleaf weeds, especially resistant strains. Tough 5EC is manufactured by Beltrum Crop Protection, an agrochemical company focused on providing innovative products with strong technical support. Ask your local retailer about Tough 5EC or visit BeltramUSA.com. Always read and follow label instructions.
The next big thing is here. From the system that brought you Roundup Ready to Extend technology comes a soybean like no other. Introducing Extend Flex Soybeans. Elite genetics, now with the addition of glufosinate tolerance. Learn more at extendflexsoy.com. Always read and follow IRM where applicable, grain marketing and all other stewardship practices and pesticide label directions. No dicamba may be used in crop with ExtendFlex soybeans unless and until approved, and no dicamba formulations are currently registered for such use in the 2021 season.
Are you combining around weed patches, waiting for weeds to dry down, or tired of spring burndown failures? Save time, nutrients, and moisture by including a Valor herbicide brand in your fall burndown program. Valor provides excellent residual control of tough weeds, including kochia, marestail, prickly lettuce, dandelion, plus suppression of bromes. Proactive, effective weed resistance management starts in the fall. Get a clean start for your next season with Valor herbicide brands. Always read and follow label directions.
You would never plant seed or apply herbicide with a 20% success rate. So why are you still applying phosphorus fertilizer with a maximum availability of only 20%? Double your phosphate availability and increase yields with NutriCharge from AgroTech USA. NutriCharge's patent-pending technology protects phosphorus from negative chemical reactions that tie up your fertilizer investment. NutriCharge performs across all soil types and pHs. Contact AgroTech USA or your local Van Deese supply representative today.
Customer service goes a long way when trying something new. Ryan Shaw from Michigan shares how Soil Warrior helped him transition to strip tillage in his operation.
The Soil Warrior guys, they are amazing to work with. They made this jump in this transition extremely painless. One question that I get all the time is, how is the service and everything? And I said, well, actually, I get better service from them than I typically do my dealers uptown. They're just amazing.
More info at SoilWarrior.com.
Success isn't just about maintaining your operation, how you make out for the season, or how much you can get from each acre. It's about doing precisely what needs to be done to feed your crop and grow your legacy, all the way down to the last drop. AgroLiquid Precision Crop Nutrition. Apply less, expect more. Find a retailer at agroliquid.com.
Listening to Ag PhD Radio. We're really excited today. We've got Neil Kinsey on with us to talk about calcium and sulfur. Neil, you can't take all the time up today with just the calcium talk, but really glad you could join us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
I like to tease Neil about calcium because I think we did a training one year where Neil talked calcium the whole day. It's that important. So, Neil, why is it so important?
Well, because calcium has an effect on so many things. It doesn't just affect the crop and how much nutrient you get in. It also affects the soil biology. It also actually is the major determinant of how much air and how much water you're going to have in each soil. So all those things that we talk about that's necessary for production, if you don't get your calcium at least close, and this is not to say that, oh, everything has to be exact, but the first thing I'd like to say in terms of this year is, if I know you fellows up there have not had a lot of rain, you've had a dry season.
Yes, very dry.
Be careful if you're pulling soil samples. Especially, some fellows will pull samples every year, and they'll see this more so than somebody that pulls it every 3 or 4 years. But what we're seeing is where those soils are extra dry, the pH drops. When the pH drops, it overinflates the amount of hydrogen that's showing in that soil to determine the exchange capacity. And if your soil exchange capacities are going up and your pHs are going down, be careful in terms of how much lime you might decide to put on, because it could be, here's the thing we tell people, take a look back on your other soil samples. And don't just look at the percentage of saturation, but look at how many pounds of calcium you had, say, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, whenever it was. Now look at how many pounds are showing up on your test now. if your test is showing the same number of pounds, but your pH is extra low, and many people say, well, our pH is low, we need to put on limestone. Take a look at your at what your total amount of calcium is in that soil. If it hasn't changed much and your exchange capacity went up, it's going to cause you to, and you follow that, it's going to cause you to over-apply calcium. Sometimes that doesn't hurt, but every time you put on calcium, if you raise that number, something else has to give way. And one of the things that you don't want to cause to give way is the percentage of potassium.
Yeah, if you over-apply lime, that is not a good thing, as we've found out on our own farm when we've got too antsy on getting some lime applications out. So yes, calcium is great, but if you overdo it, just like everything else, there's a balance here where you want some but not too much. The other thing, Neil, you mentioned just nutrient intake into the plant, and I know for us where we're putting on pretty good rates of boron in a number of our fields, if we've got our calcium-based saturation right, we can get away with that, and it looks great in the field. If we don't have enough calcium, it seems like that buffer is gone for us, and the safety factor may not be there.
And you know, that works both ways, in that we need the calcium there. The better, people will look at it as pH. We look at it as base saturation of calcium. The better your base saturation of calcium, the more boron you can apply without having adverse reactions. But the other side of the story is we'll have people that have good calcium levels and they say, well, we're not getting calcium into the plant. Well, until you put the boron on, boron gets calcium into the plant and calcium gets everything else into the plant. So calcium doesn't get itself in. When you're putting that boron on, you're actually increasing the ability of the plants to raise the calcium level if that's something you're short on at the same time as the boron is going to help in terms of the size of the seed or the fruit or whatever.
You know, one of the comments on calcium you mentioned was just the soil biology impacts of having a good level of calcium and getting the air and water balance in your soil right. And I remember you were talking to us about this a number of years ago, and obviously we've read your book more than once. Seems to be like annual reading for us to read Neil Kinsey's Hands-On Agronomy, which, by the way, if you're listening today, get yourself a copy of that if you don't have it. It's awesome. But you talk about the biology in the air and water. So we had some tough ground with like 40% base saturation magnesium. And this is where we actually ended up overdoing the calcium a little bit. We got our base saturation up between 75 and 80. So wouldn't have liked to have been quite that high. We didn't calculate right. But anyway, it still just made a radical improvement. And that soil is so much more porous. We've got so much more soil life out there. It's really been amazing.
Well, you know, you mentioned something there that doesn't get talked about very often, and that is, yes, if you start looking at percentage saturation there, the number that you generally see for calcium magnesium is on a heavy clay soil is 68% calcium and 12% magnesium. But you go over by Des Moines, Iowa, and look at some of those soybean soils. They don't have 68% calcium. They have 80. They still have high yields. You can have high percentage of calcium in a soil, and as long as you have 10 to 12% magnesium and sufficient amounts of other elements, you'll raise some of the best crops there of anywhere. So in terms of putting on that extra calcium, the question is, when you put on the calcium, can you assure or make sure that you have enough of everything else, including the micronutrients? We actually have some farmers that we'll tell you can correct your soil and get a better yield by raising your calcium up to 80 and pushing that magnesium down between 10 and 12, as long as you can keep your potassium levels up and your trace elements up.
Very interesting. All right. So one of these other nutrients, and it's not a micronutrient, but it's a secondary nutrient, sulfur, that I feel is not getting applied enough. I think a lot of soil tests we look at, a lot of plant tissue tests we look at, and a lot of crops we look at are short in sulfur. Is this a common problem worldwide, Neil, or is it something more common for the United States?
Oh, no, it's absolutely worldwide. And I would say the two things you're talking about today, calcium and sulfur, are probably the two most limiting nutrients for production around the world, not just here in the U.S. But I tell my clients, I don't believe sulfur is a secondary element. when you look at how much sulfur you need to grow a crop and how much phosphorus you need to grow a crop, it takes just as much sulfur as it does phosphorus. We might call it a secondary element, but it ought to be put right up there with NPK. It should be NPKS. We need just as much sulfur as we do phosphorus, and in vegetable crops, we need more. So now, you know, this is speaking relative. There are some crops you need a little more phosphorus than you do sulfur, but the problem is most people don't talk about phosphorus and sulfur. They talk about phosphate and sulfur. Let's talk, as my fourth grade teacher used to say, let's talk apples and apples. Convert them both to the same form, phosphate and sulfate or phosphorus and sulfur. And when you do that, what you find is we need just as much sulfur as we do phosphorus.
Very interesting. You know, I wonder where that dates back to and how that got started. But you're right. When you think about that, if you're talking phosphate, well, that number looks so much bigger. If you're talking actual phosphorus, it's quite different. And I know we get a lot of questions about that in the fertilizer industry too, here as farmers are purchasing products and they start talking one or the other. I think there's a lot of confusion out there about phosphate and phosphorus and the differences. Okay, Neil, we got only about a minute left, but what are a couple of key points here on sulfur we should know?
Well, first of all, in terms of sulfur, if you're growing a grass crop like corn and so forth, sulfate sulfur works fine, but if you put a water-soluble elemental sulfur on right at planting time or during the growing season, you can see the sulfur get into that crop in 7 days. And wheat crop the same way. We use elemental sulfur on wheat with our winter nitrogen applications, and you can tell it in a week right to the line where you put it. If you're putting nitrogen and sulfur out together and then lose some salt or don't put sulfur on a part of it, it'll look like you left the nitrogen off. But go and look. If it's the youngest leaves, it's a sulfur problem. If it's the oldest leaves, it's a nitrogen problem.
That's a
great thing. We'll have farmers, we can walk out in the field and show him that.
Yeah, I think that's really important. And I think if you take anything away from this discussion, one of the key things is walking out in the fields, looking at what the effects are when we're making different applications out there. We're talking to Neil Kinsey. Here's somebody who has walked fields literally all around the world with lots of different crops. Such a wealth of knowledge. Again, I would recommend strongly get Neil Kinsey's book, Hands on Agronomy. It's fantastic. Neil, thank you so much once again, and stay safe.
Thank you.
Listening to Ag PhD Radio. We'll be right back.
Are you combining around weed patches, waiting for weeds to dry down, or tired of spring burndown failures? Save time, nutrients, and moisture by including a Valor herbicide brand in your fall burndown program. Valor provides excellent residual control of tough weeds, including kochia, mare's tail, prickly lettuce, dandelion, plus suppression of bromes. Proactive, effective weed resistance management starts in the fall. Get a clean start for your next season with Valor herbicide brands. Always read and follow label directions.
If you're looking to get the most out of your foliar nutrition and fungicide programs, ask your ag retailer about Nutex EDA from Sipcam Agro. Nutex EDA has been proven to increase foliar micronutrient tissue levels and maintain those levels for an extended period of time. When tank mixed with fungicides, Nutex EDA helps support plant health, resulting in higher quality and yields. Nutex EDA is an affordable and effective solution that should be part of every grower's high-yield toolbox.
Make every bushel count with the Endzone Bin Fan Control System from Farm Shop MFG. Harvesting soybeans too dry causes shutter loss in the field and revenue loss from shrink when you go to market. With the Endzone, you can combine higher moisture beans earlier in the season to reduce field loss, then use your bin fans to naturally reach your target moisture. Condition your grain for maximum profit with the Endzone. For more information, visit farmshopmfg.com.
When it comes to competitive herbicide formulations, you know Nufarm. They've been bringing growers trusted brands like Weedmaster, Patriot, and Diablo for decades, made right here in the USA. What's your favorite Nufarm brand? Email it to turnuptheburn@nufarm.com and you'll be entered to win a monthly $1,000 product giveaway. In these unprecedented times, you're facing unprecedented pressure. Nufarm's here to help.
Your land is a legacy, a challenge from those who tended it before you, to build on their foundations. At Corteva Agriscience, We understand what it means to be the stewards of a legacy. We embrace the challenge of building on the foundation of Dow AgroSciences to maintain your trust, to bring new solutions, to help you care for your land. See how we can help build your legacy at rangeandpasture.com.
A history of success means proven performance, but let's call performance what it is. Profitability. And boosting yours, no matter what the season brings, is the goal of DeKalb brand corn. Backed by exclusive genetics, whole farm solutions, and unmatched dealer support. Let nothing shake your perseverance. Ask your dealer how DeKalb brand corn can help you realize a future of performance. Always read and follow IRM where applicable, grain marketing and all other stewardship practices and pesticide label directions.
Hey everybody, come on in. The Ag PhD mailbag is about to begin.
Welcome back. You're listening to Ag PhD Radio. Been talking about calcium and sulfur on today's program. Just a couple comments here before we dive into the mailbag. We'll bring Brian back on here too. We were talking with Neil Kinsey about this, and Neil's comment that these are probably the two most limiting nutrients for production, not just in North America or the United States or Canada, but for every country around the world. These are two nutrients that people just aren't getting enough of out there. And the other thing that Neil said that I thought was great, and he's talked about this before on the show, I believe, where he believes sulfur is really one of the primary nutrients. It should be N, P, K, and S. And just comparing phosphorus and sulfur and pounds used, he said, the problem is everybody talks about phosphate. He goes, why don't we talk about sulfate then and compare apples to apples? Instead, we've got an inflated number for P and comparing that against sulfur needs.
Yep, I agree with that. And, you know, quite frankly, even when we talk about the micronutrients, I kind of hate that they're called micronutrients because when you say micro, it sounds like, oh, that's not important. No, they're super important. You got to look at a complete soil test, not just NPK. So I absolutely agree with that part. But like I said earlier in the show, we're super lucky on the calcium side that at least we're in pretty good shape on calcium through much of the upper Midwest and southern Canada. Our problem is more on the sulfur side, but that doesn't mean that we don't have some issues with calcium as well. We really encourage every farmer out there to do a good job with zone testing or grid testing, whatever it is, but just don't do composite testing because all that does is tells you the average on a field. Well, that's not going to help you get higher yields.
Nope, that's for sure. And that's really the goal here when we're talking about this is we want to get more yield. But listening to Neil, too, he said, don't forget about the impacts on soil biology. Don't forget about the air and water difference you can have in your soil when you get these things balanced out, especially the calcium. There are a lot of things that go into this that help our crop, but also help our soil and the soil biology that's out there in our field that's going to make a big difference for us for years and years to come.
Yep, I agree 100%.
All right, let's dive into the Ag PhD mailbag here. We got the first question that comes in. It said, I have friends who will not turn a wheel on the combine until their soybeans are under 13% moisture. Understand that they do haul their beans to town. They don't have any bins, but they say the shrink is too high at the elevator and they lose too many bushels. On the other hand, I'm running at 14 to 14.5% moisture, and I'm always a couple hours ahead of them before they get going trying to harvest beans drier. Now, I realize 13% is optimum at the elevator, but it's a lot of time for me to lose if I have to wait an extra hour or two every day just for the beans to get a little bit drier. So I'm wondering, how much is it really costing me? Also, what's the loss between taking a 14.5% moisture bean on the wet side versus a 11% moisture bean on the too dry side in terms of shrink and bushels lost?
Okay, here's what you got to remember with shrink. It's roughly 1.5%. It's not 1%. So it's not point for point. So if you say, oh, I'm at 14.5%, I'm going to deliver 1.5% more beans approximately, okay? No, you're not. It's 1.5 times 1.5. So just like those 11% moisture beans, you're not losing 2%. You're losing 3%. you're going to give up 2 points in moisture, but the shrink is roughly 1.5 per point. And part of the reason why that is, so just stop and think logically about this. Yes, there is the loss of the moisture, okay? That is mostly 1-for-1. But the reason why shrink on soybeans is 1.5 is because of all the other fine particles that go up in the air, the splits, the cracks, the field loss that happens before you get there, the loss that happens during harvest. So if you can harvest those beans a little wetter, you're going to bring more beans to town. So when you say, all right, I'm at 14.5% moisture, well, in effect, you're hauling 2.25% more beans to town. So look at what your dock is, and yes, it's not as good as if you were able to harvest your beans at exactly 13 and haul them in at exactly 13. But the problem is, we all know, any of us who've ever harvested soybeans before, that those beans go from 13 down to 10 real fast. So sure, if you can harvest them between 12 and 13, that's great. That's what I would shoot for. But if you say, well, you know what, I'm going to start at 14, 14.5, so I don't have beans at 11 or 10 or 8, you're money ahead to do it. We talk about this almost every year on Ag PhD TV as well, and just run through some quick numbers. But, you know, the example I give all the time is 8% moisture beans. It happened to us even on our farm this year. I thought I was right there, but we simply could not go fast enough because we didn't have any rain for 3 months. And we tried. We did part fields. We did everything, but we had just a little bit that was at 8. Okay, well, if it's at 8% moisture, I lost 7.5% of my yield. 7.5%. That's enormous. I can't afford those kind of losses on a big scale. Now, fortunately, it's a tiny little scale. But I'm just saying, yeah, you're way ahead. Start at 14. Absolutely, it's what I recommend to every farmer out there who can't do all their beans, like, in a day. So if it's going to take you a week or 2 weeks to harvest your beans, you've got to start at 14. And here's the other thing. Consider going into fields and taking part of the field out and coming back later to finish the field. We did a bunch of that this year. We've almost never done that before. Quite frankly, what I pray for is we get a light rain just as we're about ready to start harvest, so it keeps things kind of even. But this year, since there was no rain in the forecast at all, hadn't had rain, we did hilltops, then we came back a week or 10 days later, did valleys, and then we were able to catch most everything at 12 to 13.
Right. Thanks for the questions. Really appreciate that. Harvesting timely, really, really important deal. You don't even get into harvest loss and all those other things that you run into. And I always think, rather than comparing about, well, they wait till 13. Yes, they may have harvested some at 13 the same day, but I'm worried about, like you said, all that time lost. Now you're harvesting for a few more days. And what are you harvesting those last few days of harvest? Oftentimes very, very dry beans. This year, a lot of 8% and 9% moisture beans. So I'd get after it too. All right, this one comes in from JR. He said, I'm interested in getting some tiling work done, but some of my friends that have done some tiling out here say it's not always super easy to get great results. I'm in a part of Illinois that has very little topsoil. We've got tight, droughty soils. I'm wondering, can tiling still help us? Do we need to space our tile lines closer? And would you start on your better fields first, or would you rather start on some lighter ground?
Okay, so the ground you're talking about sounds exactly like ours. Very little topsoil, droughty soil, and I just say in Illinois you definitely get more rainfall than what we do. But absolutely, tile can work. If it works for us, it certainly can work for you. Where I would start, if you've never, so first of all, I really encourage everybody do their own tiling. Now, I'm not saying you have to put in all your own mains or anything else, but it's not that much money to buy a tile plow. It's a very easy job to do, and you can at least put the laterals in and put the little stuff in. That's a piece of cake. So anyway, if and I don't know if he's having this custom done or not custom done, but I would just say, what I always tell people is, if you've never done a tile project before, just take your worst ground. I mean, the worst stuff for tile, and take something that's easy to tile. So in other words, something that's got a lot of slope, yet you're still having drainage issues. So that usually means valleys. You're going to do a valley. And what we suggest that you do on a valley is, don't be right where the grass waterway is. Go 10 feet, 15 feet outside of that so you don't get your line plugged up. But be on each side of that valley, and then run your lines in, not only into the side hill in the end, but go way up, I mean like way up into the side hill. So that was a mistake we made at first too. And in terms of how far apart your line should be, that's a personal preference. And it's also a lot, it has a lot to do with how heavy that soil is. The heavier the soil, the closer together the lines need to be. And the more shallow you put your lines, the closer together those lines need to be. So judgment call, I guess I'd just say set things up so you can expand later or add some lines later.
Yep, that's a great rule of thumb. Always set yourself up where you can do more later if you find out that, hey, you know what? I need another tie line here to get things done. Thanks for the question. Really appreciate that, JR. We'll be right back with more after this.
You need a powerful herbicide to fight the war on weeds. Bellum is Rotem North America's mesotrione herbicide, and it fights against the annual broadleaf weeds attacking your cornfields. Winning this battle means higher yields, lower cost to you, and maximized profitability. For long-lasting residual weed control, check out Evinco Vilify and our newest mix, Rixa. For application, flexibility, and season-long control, that's Evinco Vilify and Rixa, powered by Bellum. For more information, visit bellumherbicide.com. That's B-E-L-L-U-M herbicide.com.
Each year brings new and unique challenges to farming, and your operation needs to constantly adapt to meet them. That's why at AgBiome, we're working every day to bring you new and better solutions. Microbial-based solutions that protect your crop and help it reach its full potential. To learn more about how we're doing it, visit agbiome.com. That's AGBIOME.com. AgBiome, feeding the world responsibly. Partnering with microbes for human benefit.
Success isn't just about maintaining your operation, how you make out for the season, or how much you can get from each acre. It's about doing precisely what needs to be done to feed your crop and grow your legacy, all the way down to the last drop. AgroLiquid Precision Crop Nutrition. Apply less, expect more. Find a retailer at agroliquid.com.
Pentair Hypro Ultra Low Drift Nozzles are your ideal choice for the Enlist E3 herbicide system. With coverage comparable to flat fans and with 90% less drift, ULD nozzles meet all required standards for Enlist applications and provide optimal performance of contact herbicides. Learn more at pentair.com/hypro.
Make every bushel count with the End Zone Bin Fan Control System from Farm Shop MFG. Harvesting soybeans too dry causes shatter loss in the field and revenue loss from shrink when you go to market. Condition your grain for ideal moisture with the End Zone. Visit farmshopmfg.com for more.
You're all set with the 4x4 turbo diesel truck. How about some options? Spray and bed liner?
Absolutely.
Tailgate step and Nerf bars?
Gotta have them.
Tie down hooks and stainless steel toolbox?
You know it.
Tinted windows?
Of course.
Options are good. That's as true in the field as it is with your pickup. In addition to taking care of tough weeds, new Open Sky herbicide gives you more rotational choices than ever before and an easy-to-handle formulation.
Gooseneck tow package?
Yep.
Discover more Open Sky details at openskyherbicide.com.
The only innovation that matters is the one I need.
With NK Seeds, their R&D program actually listens to farmers like me, so I get solutions that solve my challenges.
With the support to make them count. Because progress means pushing my potential, and success matters.
Push your potential at nkseeds.com.
Back, you're listening to Ag PhD Radio. We're taking your calls and questions throughout the rest of the show at 844-44-AG-PHD, or you can email us radio@agphd.com. All right, pretty straightforward question here, Brian. This one comes from Jeff in Southern Illinois, and he writes, well, what is the best pH for Southern Illinois soils in a corn, bean, wheat three-crop rotation?
We usually say 6.3 to 6.8, so I don't know. If I was to say one exact pH, what would it be? I might lean on a little on the lower side in the 6.3 to 6.5 range, somewhere in there, but you know, you want it above 6 and below 7. Let's leave it at that.
Yeah, and it doesn't have to be. Like Neil Kinsey was talking about, sometimes we're shooting for some of these targets, and he said you can raise great crops even when you don't have everything just perfect. But
exactly.
But yeah, if you're at a 9 pH or a 4 pH, yeah, it's going to be a lot harder to do than if you're in that medium range. And the reason why is you've got better nutrient availability, you got better soil microbial life, you got a lot of things going right for you, and your pH is really an indication of what kind of nutrient balance you've got in your soil. So if you've got something way out of balance, it's going to drive that pH up or down in a lot of cases. So when you get that pH about right, that's a good situation to be in, no doubt about it.
Well, wait a second, though. When you say about right, there is no exact about right, number one. And number two, it will vary depending on the crop. So, for example, he didn't say alfalfa. If he would have said alfalfa, I'd say, oh, I want a 7 pH. I definitely don't want to be any lower than 6.8. If he would have said blueberries, I would have said a 5.5 pH, and I definitely don't want to be any higher than 6. So it does absolutely depend on your crop.
All right. I don't totally agree with you on the blueberries, but yes, I like that 6.3 to 6.8 for the crops that you're raising. I just think, Brian, with the blueberries, that a lot of them happen to be growing in areas where the pH is super low, but I don't think you have to have a super low pH to grow a blueberry.
You don't have to, but you seem to get more production.
They can survive in those soils better, yes. All right, let's go to the next question. This one comes from Freddie, and he said, all right, I see your corn that you're showing, but my corn never looks like that in the garden with the brace roots growing down into the ground and things like that. How come your corn always looks much better than mine in my garden?
Well, that's a great question. I don't know exactly, but I do know we're not talking about the same corn. We're talking field corn usually on our show. So what you're looking at is a field corn plant as opposed to a sweet corn plant. So that's part of it. The other part is just, I would say, let's take a look at nutrients. Do a soil test. If you want us to take a look at your soil test, we'd be more than happy to do that. My guess is there might be an issue there with some of your nutrient levels. But I just keep in mind, sweet corn is not nearly as hardy as field corn. So it's got to have better conditions to do very well.
All right, speaking about conditions, get this question from Mark in Nebraska. He said, there's a lot of people talking about taking deep soil nitrate samples in the fall. Am I crazy for thinking it's too early to be taking deep soil nitrate tests? I'd rather do that into part of next season when we're split applying nitrogen and look at that partway into the growing season. What would be your opinion?
Yes, I would agree with him. So people do it right now, and then they say, well, I've got, 50 extra pounds that's down in that 6 to 24-inch range, and my crop might be able to get that. And I would agree, your crop might be able to get that. But the problem is, when your crop could use that would be next May or June, and how much rain are you going to get between now and then? How long is your growing season going to continue this fall? How early is it going to start next spring? I mean, we don't have the answers to those questions. So if I had very heavy soil and I was in a dry area of the country, then I don't mind it. If I have light soil and I have lots of rainfall, then you're wasting your money, in my opinion, sampling this early for deep nitrate.
Yep. It's good to bring that point up, Mark. Thanks for that question. I really appreciate that.
Good. Oh, and I just want to say, with a lot of these things we talk about, and that's why I try to make the distinction, there are areas where deep soil nitrate testing right now is fine. I don't have a big issue with it. And that's why I don't know what situation he's in exactly, what part of Nebraska he's in. Western Nebraska is dramatically different from Eastern Nebraska, and soil types vary. So, I mean, you got to weigh all these factors in. And so maybe it is a good decision for some of those guys to be out there testing it, but maybe not. And so you just understand it's light soil and amount of rainfall. Those are the two things you're looking at.
All right, let's get back to the phone lines here. We've got John with us in southeast Minnesota. John, it sounds like this snowfall today caught you by surprise too.
Just a tad bit, yeah. We just got finished cleaning out our beef barn, our pit, and we put it on top this year, and we're waiting about 12, 14, 24 hours to work it back in, and of course it starts snowing and raining on us. My question is, nitrogen loss with this rain and the snow. Are we going to lose a lot? How panicky should we be? Right now, my son's out there kind of trying to mud it in, which isn't working real great.
No, I bet not. Oh, what a nightmare. Yeah. You know, we've been so dry here. We've been praying for that rain. So it's probably our fault, John. It actually came your way. We got this light dusting of snow that barely got the concrete wet here. It wasn't a big deal, but you're right. You got a whole bunch of cattle manure out in the field that you need to get tilled in. And now this unexpected snow pops up and all of a sudden that 20 or 30% chance of snow becomes 100% chance of a mess.
Yeah, we actually, the ground underneath is really dry. If we can get through it, it actually comes up dry, but it's kind of a slimy mess on top. So if we go to, if I guess the question is, how much are we going to lose, or how much do I have to compensate for next spring when I put urea on? Because we've only put like 4,000 gallons on, so 100 pounds of actual nitrogen. Are we going to lose 5%, 10%, or if you have a crystal ball to tell me what the weather's going to do?
Right. Now, let's say this dries out, say that it just, it passes through and you're back in there by the end of the day tomorrow. Is the nitrogen loss going to be huge? Probably not. If it's, hey, this is it, and this is your last shot this season, and now we're going to have wetting of that manure and then drying and wetting and drying, that could be a bad deal. What do you think, Brian? How much nitrogen loss are we going to have?
Yeah, it all depends on how much rainfall you get. So, okay, so Darren, you gave two examples. All right, let's say it does dry out here in the next couple of days. You're going to lose very little of that. But one of the ways you can kind of tell, just as a simple method, is how bad does it smell? The worse it smells, the more you're losing. And so you got a couple of days, and it's not going to be horrific, your loss here. But to Darren's point, if, okay, you can't get back in and at all, well, that tells you you're going to get tremendous amounts of rainfall. Because if it's dry underneath, it'd take a lot of rain for you not to get back in. Well, if you're going to get a lot of rain, then that nitrogen's going to go down in the ground. I'm not that worried. The bigger thing I would look at is, if you can't get back in there, is your phosphorus, potassium, copper, zinc, some of these nutrients that are in manure that don't move down in the soil. If you don't get to till them in, well, they're just laying on that soil surface. And now if you have any soil erosion this fall or next spring before you get the chance to work it, you could potentially lose some of those nutrients. So you've got two different things we're looking at here. You know, the loss of the nitrate or the loss of those other nutrients. So let's just hope and pray that it does dry out now. You can get in there, work it, and then everything should be all good.
Otherwise, we get an overnight frost, it gets hard, and we can go out and work it that way. That would be good, too. So.
Yep, that's right. Yep, we're in kind of the same boat.
All right, thanks, guys. I'm going to lose you. I'm going over some hills.
Oh, you bet. Thanks a lot, John. Really appreciate the call. Yeah, there's a lot of situations that pop up when the weather changes like that and surprises folks, no doubt about it. You know, Brian, we talked calcium and sulfur on today's program, and there were just so many good comments that came out of that, and actually getting some feedback about it too. Just talking about sulfur and fall application, the last thing that we didn't really cover. In the north, soils are going to freeze for 6 months, heavy dirt, lots of organic matter. Are you nervous about sulfur in the fall?
No. I'm not worried about losing it in our situation. So again, it really varies. If you've got heavy soil, you're going to freeze soon, you don't get lots of rainfall, no, absolutely I'm not worried about losing that sulfur between now and spring, as long as you're going to plant that crop relatively early in the spring. If you're not going to plant till the middle of June, well, that's a different story. But as long as you're planting relatively early in the spring, go ahead and put your sulfur on this fall, in that case.
All right. Yeah, always a fun discussion when we get into some of those nutrients like sulfur that can potentially be leachable when we get into light soils and heavy rainfall. Thanks for listening to our program today. Be sure to join us each weekday for more Ag PhD Radio.